Hey, this is Scott Finn, CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and co-host of The Front Porch. The episode you're about ready to hear was taped before the allegations came out about Prairie Home Companion former host Garrison Keillor. So keep that in mind as you're listening to the podcast, and thanks for your understanding. And you're on The Front Porch. Today, we're going to be the last podcast in America to talk about sexual harassment, but we're going to talk about it from a West Virginia perspective. And then also the deal with China Energy. China Energy signed an $83.7 billion MOU promising investment in West Virginia, but will it actually occur? And we're going to meet a new guest host here, Jesse Troyan. Jesse is the development director of the Cardinal Institute, which is a free market policy research organization based here in Charleston. Hey, Jesse, how you doing?
Glad to be here.
And of course, as always, Rick Wilson from the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I am good. How about yourself?
I'm great. Well, let's just start by getting to know Jesse a little bit. Jesse, you grew up in Pinch, West Virginia, a little town outside of Charleston, right?
That's correct. About 10 minutes drive north of here.
You got educated at WVU and then got your PhD, right?
In economics from George Mason University.
You want to call you Dr. Jesse?
No, please don't.
Okay. I like the sound of that, though. Okay, so anyway, so you got your PhD in George Mason, which is in Virginia.
Fairfax, Virginia, so the D.C. suburbs.
And lived there for like 5 years?
5 years.
Why'd you come home?
So being in the Fairfax area, the traffic, the high cost of living, some of the days that I would go to campus, the 3-mile trek between my apartment and campus could take me up to a half an hour, where in contrast, now according to Google Maps, my commute into work is 13 miles and it takes me 20 minutes.
How can West Virginia compete for young talent like you with places like DC and New York and Charlotte? Like, what do we have that they don't?
The biggest thing for me, I would say, it's the sense of belonging and just being able to capture the opportunity that fits per individual. And not everybody is going to be as lucky as me. If you're an individual who's in the healthcare field, it's going to be much easier to find an opportunity to either bring your talents back or to keep your talents here in the first place. But when the heartstrings call from home, take the chance, answer the call, and come back and appreciate what West Virginia has to offer.
So we've been speaking with Jesse Troyan, who's with the Cardinal Institute and guest host today with me and Rick Wilson. And we are now the last radio show in America to take up the topic of sexual harassment. Usually we try to bring a West Virginia angle to this, and we will today. To my knowledge, there really hasn't been the sort of disclosures in West Virginia media and politics that you've seen at a national level about sexual harassment, at least not yet. You know, Rick, when you've been watching this, what have you been thinking about?
One thing that strikes my mind, sort of an aspect of this that you don't often hear, and that's how like low-income people and people like immigrants who are already relatively marginalized and powerless are even more likely to be victims of a much higher degree of this kind of thing. So poverty always has a multiplier effect on negative things, and this is another example.
So, Jesse, what, you know, you've been looking at this as well. What's your take on it from sort of a free market perspective?
So, especially as an economist by training, I tend to look at things in terms of what are the relevant costs and benefits. And from the perspective of the predator here, for lack of a better word, these marginalized groups, these immigrants, these low-skilled workers, it is relatively less costly for the predator to take advantage of the power structure that they're in. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
No, that's an interesting way of putting it. It's almost like, you know, the predator does, to some extent, weigh the potential cost of his actions. And if the people he's preying on have less power, he's more likely to take advantage of that.
In general, predators are lazy. Like, my cat sleeps 20 hours a day. When he doesn't sleep, he's dozing. You know, they don't want a big fight, typically, you know, and so that power dynamic, that inequality makes a real tempting target, I think.
And one last thing, which is I do find it interesting that we haven't had this blow up in West Virginia yet. There hasn't been a single high-profile person accused like you've seen in other places. And I don't know if that's just because we have a different culture or if it's not happening here as much, which I'm skeptical about, or what, but I do find it interesting that it hasn't really hit the scene here in West Virginia in the same way.
Not yet. But, you know, the root of this, I think, is inequality. I mean, anytime you have extreme inequality of any kind, it encourages predation on the part of the powerful, period. My inspirational quote is from the life of Frederick Douglass, where he observed in the plantations that the slave who was the easiest to beat was beaten the most often.
But how do we deal with the fact that it's hard to know what happens in these situations, especially when they've happened a long time ago?
That's a really good question. So I would say to begin with that these more social ramifications, the losing of your job, trial by court of public opinion, that these kind of social shaming mechanisms, I'm reasonably okay with individuals losing their jobs based upon these detailed allegations and sort of patterns of this behavior, which is a completely separate issue from we're going to lock you up, put you in jail. There's a different standard of proof that I think that I really feel like should be met to deprive one of, you know, your life and your liberty versus your job.
Freedom of the employer, in this case, like NBC, to say, you know, we don't need to have 100% proof to decide that Matt Lauer is now bad for our brand and we don't want to hire him anymore because of that, even if they don't have 100% proof. What do you think, Rick?
In general, I'm as a pro-labor, pro-union person, I do think it's good for people to have, you know, some kind of appeal, some kind of due process on the job if they feel like they're being discriminated against. Not making excuses for any kind of inappropriate behavior, but in general, you could fire someone because they looked at you the wrong way or because you didn't like them or whatever. So the one thing that labor organizations do is at least provide some representation for people. So
thank you for that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the China energy deal. Should we be excited? And if so, how much? But first.
I'm Sarah Brown from Charleston. A lot of people in politics certainly want to control their own message, and so they're giving you their talking points, and it takes a really quality reporter to be able to say, what about this? What about that? I don't think that's true. This is the example I have. And public broadcasting reporters do that. They push their subjects to be able to really flesh out what the real situation is.
Protect West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Go to wvpublic.org.
All right, we're back on the front porch with Jessie Troyan. She's the development director of the Cardinal Institute, which is a free market policy research organization based in Charleston. Hey, Jessie.
Hey.
And we have, as always, Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey.
How would I describe the American Friends Service Committee of West Virginia in like a line?
You shouldn't.
Quakers kicking butt, basically.
That's a punchy tagline, though.
I do like that. Have you tried that?
You're the master of coming up with clever marketing ploys, so I wouldn't get in your territory, Scott.
But then again, the kicking butt might go against their pacifism.
It could be like metaphorical or...
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about something that's come up in West Virginia recently, which is the China energy deal. President Trump goes to China, and while he is there, he negotiates $250 billion worth of potential business deals with America, including, get this, $83.7 billion that China Energy, which is a Chinese conglomerate, is promising to invest in West Virginia over the next couple of decades.
I hear they're checking the mailbox every day, Scott.
Well, you know, I read in an article in the Wheeling paper, Governor Justice saying, hey, look, if we get $1 billion of that, that's still two Procter & Gamble plants. But I guess that is the question, Rick. Is it a game changer, as some people have said, or are you just skeptical it's ever going to happen? How do you feel about all this?
Well, I think it's an unknown at this point. There's not a lot of, you know, nothing's really ironed out. There's not a lot of details. It could be a significant investment, and it could have a lot of different consequences depending on how it plays out. I don't think the game has changed yet.
They're talking about, Jesse, this is mostly like natural gas and petrochemical type investment, right?
Correct.
And it's an
That's
MOU.
My understanding.
As a trained PhD economic person, what does that actually mean, an MOU? Is that something to get excited about? Is it not? What do you think?
You know, my background and expertise doesn't shed a whole lot of light on what to make out of a memorandum of understanding, but I think we can all agree that there is no contractual obligation in place. And I think it's very fair to hold on to some of our skepticism.
And this is a state enterprise, which means officially it's the communist. It's the Chinese communist. Of course, communism in China, it ain't what it used to be.
No, but it's heavily state. I mean, they're state-owned companies. The state directs a lot of the credit and other policies. I mean, I just looked up the program of the Chinese Communist Party recently to see. They say this capitalistic period may last for 100 years or so.
Oh, they think they're going to go back to the socialist paradise after the capitalist period?
I think the idea is, you know, that the idea that this will continue until its productive capacities have maxed out and then transition over. Just funny. I just read that the other day.
Fascinating. I didn't even know they were trying to, you know,
They're still trying, apparently, yeah.
So should we be concerned at all that it's a Chinese company? Does that matter?
From my perspective, I would say that the Chinese making this investment in America, that there's a tacit understanding of entering into the American economic system means that you are going to be held to the rules of the system as it is here, not the set of rules that exist in China.
Investment is investment. As long as they follow the rules, it's good investment. I mean, people putting money into building plants, employing West Virginians can be a good thing, except you said that there are some people with other concerns about this development.
There are a couple of interesting articles in the press, one in the Gazette about, does this mean we're going to be a mineral colony for another 100 years, because that worked out so well the last time. But the most interesting one was from the Wheeling Intelligencer. First, the writer is talking about how King Coal was declined and how we were dealing with that, and he says, some of our leaders in the state refused to throw up our hands in despair. They suggested ways for us to move forward, to rebuild our economy. Diversification was an idea put forward. This is a good one. So is preparing our children for careers in which they, not anything pulled from the earth, was viewed as a valuable resource. And he asked, what are we going to do now? And, you know, are we just going to coast, or are we going to still pursue other strategies, including tourism, high-tech manufacturing, healthcare? And he even calls for taking a look at the Future Fund, which is something that Jeff Kessler championed. If there's going to be another real sustained boom in that, well, there should be a way of capturing some kind of lasting benefit for the state.
So the concern is that we might give lip service to diversification. And ever since I moved here almost 30 years ago, people talk about we need to diversify. But as long as we have, in one case it was coal, and now increasingly it's natural gas that's propping up the economy, the impetus to actually diversify the economy isn't there. We don't do it. And then what happens, boom, bust, eventually the natural gas runs out and we're back where we started again without diversifying our economy. Or is this a way for us to do it differently this time? I mean, they're talking about not just taking the natural gas out, but actually building plants to transform it into chemicals and to rebuild our petrochemical industry here.
I mean, that'd be preferable than just having it sucked away, which is the usual process in this state. So.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you there that I think if we're going to broaden out, and it's not just the extraction, but it's the downstream products, that helps in this diversification process. Another thing to think about, too, is not all of these jobs are going to be relatively lower skilled, maybe I might call them like medium skilled type of blue collar jobs, in the same way that I think a lot of the coal jobs of the bygone era were, that these jobs are going to require individuals with some more training. There's going to be an emphasis in your STEM field, science, technology, engineering and mathematics. And I think that this investment gives us an opportunity to really give West Virginia's youth an incentive to more seriously consider and more seriously pursue those fields that we typically talk about as being, you know, hey, this is where the opportunities lie. There's a tangible sort of job in West Virginia, hopefully waiting for you.
Yeah, and then the other thing that we see a lot, and we've done a lot of like educational videos for the community college system and also for K-12 education around this. Young people don't understand enough that there are lots of jobs in that sweet spot, more than a high school diploma, but less than a 4-year bachelor degree. Really good paying jobs. I'll give you an example. The Toyota plant has a special program with Bridge Valley Community College where it's advanced manufacturing training. And they will actually pay you to go and go through this program. And at the end of the program, they're almost guaranteed a high-paying job at the Toyota plant. Right? You think that they would have people beating down the door to get in this program. It is a fact that they often have trouble filling out the whole class that they need. Part of the problem is that parents are not encouraging their kids to go into these programs. They're encouraging them to go and get four-year degrees to the exclusion of these sorts of things that might pay better and for some kids are a much better option than trying to get a four-year degree and maybe dropping out and not having anything.
I do think that that's a broader issue that we do need to address is that a four-year degree is not the answer for everybody. I have a cousin outside of the Pittsburgh area that during high school, he trained to weld. With a little more than a high school degree and the on-the-job training, you know, he makes nearly as much money, if not more than I do right now. So to some degree, maybe it's just telling the stories of these individuals who say, by being a little bit smarter about the training and the opportunities that I could get, I'm able to have a well-paying job without a fancy sheet of paper hanging on my wall that I'm also now five figures worth of debt into.
Do you think that when you have an industry that's a dominant industry in an area like coal or like natural gas, does it push out innovation and entrepreneurship?
I do think that it invites complacency.
There's the resource curse.
Well, do you believe in the resource curse?
Yeah. I am familiar with that. There is definitely that risk, but I think the broader question is what are the rules of the game in the economic system outside of that? Do we have a system that is explicitly favoring putting ever more resources into the sacred cow industry?
One thing that this brings up, you know, a few years ago, Senate President then Jeff Kessler campaigned on the idea of a future fund, and it passed in 2014 with bipartisan support. And the idea behind it was, and I'm going to trash some Democrats on this one, the idea was to set aside a portion of our severance taxes on natural gas when they reached a certain point and just let it build up, leave the principal intact, and then as it build up, use the interest from that for investments in education, infrastructure, whatever. It'd actually be a way of paying for things without new taxes, you know, and it's creating sort of sovereign wealth for the United States. Like Alaska has it, a lot of conservative states, Minnesota, Texas has one, Wyoming. And the big one, Norway's, theirs is like over $1 trillion they've actually captured. Because when it comes out of the ground and it's gone, you lose it. But if you can capture some kind of source of permanent value. And it was actually sabotaged by Democrats in the House in 2014. They actually made it weaker. And
who didn't want to lose the income? Like they wanted it today. They didn't want to like put aside some of it for tomorrow.
Really wanted to stick it to Kessler. I don't know why. But at some point, if there really is an increase in this, I agree with what the Wheeling editorial writer says. We need to look at that future fund and make it workable. So that we don't get stuck again like we did the last 100 years.
And it's really easy to look back at the past and just shake your head because not only did we not take a percentage of that wealth for the future, but we actually, as a state, we indebted ourselves in all these different ways. Unpaid pension liabilities stacked up over the years, workers' comp liabilities. There are all these things that the state basically got us in debt for that we're just now starting to dig ourselves out of. And you think if people had been more responsible back when the extraction industries were doing really well, then maybe we'd be in a better shape right now to be able to, you know, have a better economy today. Instead, we're still paying for the sins of the past.
And we're also paying for their externalities, the costs they passed on to the public.
So, China Energy, I guess the verdict is wait and see. In general, though, isn't this a win for President Trump? And isn't this an argument that West Virginia's support for President Trump, we were, depending on how you count it, either the Trumpiest state or the second Trumpiest state in the country, that it's being rewarded because we definitely got attention and, you know, we're definitely part of the conversation in when they were over in China. Shouldn't we give Trump some credit here?
Go ahead.
I guess I just did. I mean, one of the arguments that Governor Justice is making for switching parties is because he says it helps me to have more influence on the president. Coal mining is up. Maybe that's coincidental, but it's true. I think it's something like more than a quarter over last year at this time. Severance taxes are way up, especially in natural gas. This, the China energy deal. I think regular people look at it and say President Trump's been really good for West Virginia.
I mean, it's hard to disentangle the correlation right here. You know, it certainly doesn't imply that if not for Trump, that any of these things wouldn't have materialized. So it's tough to, you know, really ascribe bona fide credit, I would say. But it certainly isn't hurting West Virginia.
I mean, the same way that we blamed, a lot of people blamed President Obama for the decline in the coal industry. How much of that was him? And it's hard to disentangle that from his decisions versus larger structural changes. Rick, I'm going to give you the last word on
this. There's the ancient Greek story of Solon and Croesus, who the punchline of which, call no one happy until you've seen how they spent their last hour upon the earth. But wait to see how the story ends.
That's ominous. And on that scary note, this has been The Front Porch. We've been joined by a guest host this week, Jesse Troyan, the development director of the Carnell Institute. Jesse, thank you for coming on.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
And Rick Wilson. Is it Cressida?
Mythology. Cassandra.
The Cassandra of West Virginia and, of course, the American Friends Service Committee. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'm Scott Finn. Thanks for listening.